The following is a presentation of Open for Business, InterVarsity Christian Fellowship's conference for business students and business professionals at the Urbana 06 Missions Convention, held in St. Louis, December 2006. For more information, please visit ofb.intervarsity.org.
Practices, okay? So kind of get your gearing right, and not best practices. Practices not sanctioned by us. Please do not try these at home. Ben, can you give us the first one here? So, not best practices. Okay, the commentary is jack stands. Ah, I don't mean those stinking jack stands. You kind of see what's going on there, right? So this guy is a master of improv here. Okay, next slide. Right. Number six, necessity is the mother of invention, but sometimes necessity should be used birth control. So we got a forklift holding up another forklift, getting up to there. So, okay, kind of doing what you can, right? Next one. And to think, those wimps at the power company use straps and cleats to get up this high. So, okay. He showed a little faith there. Okay, this guy still wonders why he got fired that day. Now, can you see what's going on here? That's a forklift. That's the dock it came off of, and that's a bomb. Okay, so how about that? All right, next slide. Gee, guys, that seems like an awful lot of protective gear for such a small chlorine gas station. That one's my favorite. Okay, next slide. Step one, remove shoes. Step two, place metal ladder in water. Step three, begin using power tools while standing barefoot on metal ladder in water. Electrifying, how about that? Okay, and number one, okay. As I said, does he have a greater faith than you or I? Okay. You know, sometimes we need to try different things and stretch and have a greater faith. We're all for that. And we're with World Relief. You can go to the next group of slides. We'll shut that one down. I wish I could give credit to where that came from. I have no idea. It was one of those things that circulated on the net around the world 100 times. I would give due credit to that. But we're with World Relief. The tonight's session is transitioning from disaster relief to economic development. World Relief is a 60-year-old organization. We started during World War II. We're a subsidiary of the National Association of Evangelicals. And so during World War II, it was the Evangelicals Church's response to refugees and people around the world that were in dire need. Tonight, I'm joined by Ben, my colleague Ben Lydecker. He's back there on that laptop. And then Kathy Yonker, she's back here as well. They're the bouncers, so if they're... If anybody kind of starts rushing the front, they've assured me they'll rush out the back. And apparently this is going to be recorded tonight, so now I've got the fear of the Lord here if I don't say every precise word. I feel sorry for pastors. You know, every single word they say is scrutinized. That's okay. We'll give God grace here tonight. From disaster relief to economic development, World Relief is a responder organization. Our specialty is post-conflict and natural disaster areas. So we'll go in and do work in hard places, and we'll start with disaster relief, and the catch is going to economic development. We're going to go into that really briefly. Ben, can you just throw the next slide up? Just as a quick overview of where we focus in development. Somebody already asked me this before we met. We specialize in microfinance. For several reasons. I'll get into that a little bit later. But this is somewhat representative of where we are today. In the past 30 or 40 years, we were in other countries doing economic relief and development. But our microfinance programs span from Kosovo, Cambodia, Bangladesh, Rwanda, Mozambique, Burundi, Eastern Congo, World of Haiti, other places. We've spun off programs. The blue programs are programs that we've spun off or that we've partnered with over time. And there's others kind of 10 years before this group that we started up and spun off another 10 or 15. So our history is to start programs, start them as NGOs, and ultimately build up the base, get them sustainable, keep them on mission, and then allow them to keep going indigenously into the future. But that's where we are now. We've got, in combination with our partners, 104,000 clients, loan portfolio of about $16 million. Okay, that's just a big picture, quick snapshot. Next slide. I'll just give you a couple quick slides here of Ground Zero looked like in Indonesia after the tsunami. Go ahead, Ben, hit the next one, too. There's three of these right in a row. Go ahead and hit the next one as well. The devastation was pretty heavy. You're in the track here, which is the BAM, the Businesses Missions track. Our organization focuses in areas where economic activity has been devastated. And we'll go through some of the process here. We observe cycles. There's both the devastation from natural disaster, but also conflict. If you're students here of what's going on in economic development, World Bank and the UN have said, okay, how many people are living under $2 a day in the world? Does anybody know that statistic? Have you heard that?
1.2.
Good. Under $2 a day across the globe, 2.2 billion people live on less than $2 a day. Okay. The number of people living on less than $1 a day in the global world is 1.2 billion. So, huge numbers living on less than a dollar a day. Okay, that's part of the poor that we see. The part of the segment of the poor that we work with are, okay, within that range, generally speaking, now we're working with those people that find themselves in post-conflict scenarios. So not only may they be poor, but also they're being impacted by conflict. The structures have been broken. The economy, the educational system, the family life has been devastated and torn. There are people without hope. They are the poor that we work with. And this is going to be one expression of business's mission. We're doing micro enterprise development. We're focusing on microfinance, but we'll get into that in just a moment. Ben, will you throw up the next slide? This is just, I don't even need to put this up because you know why you're here and God's motivated you to be here, but in case anybody forgot about it, why should believers be involved with disastrous relief and economic development? Well, it's what would Jesus do, you know? He would grieve with those that are grieving, he would serve those, have compassion, and he met physical needs. That was part of his ministry, equal parts with the spiritual ministry. Okay, it's missional. It's great commandment stuff. It's serving, it's loving your neighbor as yourself. And then, lastly, business and professional people need to be in the game. And you know this too, so I'm singing to the choir, but this is kingdom work. And there's skills and gifting that you have, and it should be engaged in the kingdom. There's no question about it. We're all ministers. Some of us need to be ministering with our business skills. So, it's lordship over your time, talent, and treasure. Hey, we're blessed to be a blessing. That's Abrahamic covenant stuff, right? We're blessed to be a blessing. We have been endowed with much. We have many resources here. Our credentials, our academic skills, our business skills, we've been endowed with much. There's much we can share. And then, of course, for such a time as this, never before, does this feel like a fullness of time to you? Isn't there something exciting happening right now? We can touch every part of the world now like never before. Our communication technology, transportation skills, anywhere. And our business skills can get us there. Our English skills can get us there like never before. There's something special happening right now at this time. Had a person say, okay, since Jesus came, we're now in the end of times. This is feeling like the ender of times. You know, there's a lot happening right now. It's an exciting time to be engaged. And that's, I know you're here. I didn't mean to say that yet. So let's go to the next slide. Okay. How about this? What comes to your mind when you hear the phrases emergency relief? Let's start with that. That's an open question. What comes to your mind? Emergency relief. And you think what?
Flashlights.
Cool. What else?
I think of the church.
The church? Great. What else?
Temporary.
Great. What else?
Katrina.
Good. It's good word association. Keep going. What else?
Red Cross.
Great. What else?
Chaos. Ooh, great. Who said doom and gloom right there? Who said that? Okay, great. Emergency relief. Good. How about international economic development? What comes to your mind?
World Bank.
Great. What else? My grant price.
Yes.
All right. Got that on tape? Yeah, okay, good. What else?
European Union.
EU. Okay. Go EU. All right. What else?
Long-term process.
Pardon me?
A long-term process,
good.
As opposed to a short-term.
Good. Very good. I like that. And I heard back here, bureaucracy. Amen to that. Well, I was a commercial banker in the United States for 16 years. And, every 10 years or so, it seems like the world community has a debt crisis, and the big international banks have to forgive debt. And as a banker, I had a real problem with that. It's like, why do they have to forgive billions and billions of dollars of debt? You know, it's on those big macro projects, right? It's like, what's going on? So when I think of international economic development, it's kind of the bureaucracy and some of these long-term projects with turnovers in governments and who's going to do the follow-up and their massive projects and what about that? Well, let's go to the next slide. Okay, I think you hit on some of these things and these are just other things too, right? Okay, emergency relief could be food, water, shelter, health, the Red Cross shows up, it's short-term, it's immediate, generalizations. However, as we found out, disasters are usually very complex. There's layer upon layer of issue that's going on. So any one of these things sounds like, the quick fix. It's very complex. And oftentimes they're repeated. We'll talk about that in a minute. And then international economic development, ag projects, power plants, airports. What type of intervention? At what stage? At what scale? Who does it? And for many of us, we kind of see things on CNN and you just, what is that? It's a blurry thing. It kind of all comes together. It's important to define this because when we talk about economic development, there are stages that we need to be aware of. And how can we intervene with business models? What would be effective? And again, we're kind of drawing this out because this is my hour and 15 minutes. Okay? And our organization, I've been asked to speak about this subject. These markets have been devastated. And I would say to you, as you're considering business applications, you already know this as well, who's your market? What market are you trying to serve? What market analysis have you done? What's demand? What's supply? What are the other factors that go into that? And I say that because people would come up to me and they'd say, Bill, what about this intervention, this intervention, this intervention? And I would say, well, okay, where are you at in the world? who are you serving? What's your market? Okay, now, what might be a reasonable means to help that people? What would be a sustainable business? So kind of reference where we're at in this. We're talking going from relief to development. We're going from disaster where people are devastated. And the devastation isn't just physical. It's their souls and their spirits being torn with issues as well. Okay, next slide. Yep, you guys. And I'll mention, just as kind of a tie into that, Darfur, Sudan, going on 3 years now. It is an economic relief situation. It is a disaster situation. 3 years, it goes beyond all proportions. The impact of human suffering continues. We're functional. We also have work in southern Sudan, but in Darfur, there's four refugee camps. World Relief Fund is one of those. We have a medical clinic, and it's just a desperate situation. It's incredibly difficult. And I just mentioned this in terms of awareness that, tell you what, economic development here, these people are needy. There's no economic development happening. It cannot. So there's areas of the world, and there's areas of need. Again, you've got to be aware of what is going on in what context. Just looking this up, maybe for prayer, need for awareness. Call your congressman, that sort of thing. It's worthy of our prayer and focus. But economic relief, the church is called to this, and how might we engage in that? So anyway, next slide. This is what I was referring to. Oftentimes, our view of what's going on, and there were some handouts. This is on your handout, so whatever you want to look at. We look at the center circle here as being kind of a reference point. There's a disaster that happens. There's an impact here, and there's phases that happen. There's phases. There's an emergency relief phase. There's community stabilization, reconstruction, pre-impact. There's responses that are happening at the same time. There's a cycle that happens, and if you will, after an economy comes out of that cycle, what are they doing to prepare oftentimes for the next cycle? Post-conflict situations, the research says that in countries that have had a conflict, if there hasn't been economic development of like 2-3% per year with that after that crisis scenario, after that conflict, they'll be back into another war cycle within 10 years. The statistics show over and over and over again. So economic development actually is an offset, is a deterrence to conflict. And the truth of that is, in some of our programs, we go into, after genocide, after people be killing each other. We believe in peace and reconciliation through economic development, through microfinance. If both sides or multiple sides, if they're in bed, if they're getting income, there's a lot less fight about. There's a lot less idle hands. There's a lot less gossip. There's a lot less tearing apart. They're busy providing for their family, so it's a good thing. So I'll just mention that. And then the other thing we've observed, now I'll kind of do a linear thing too. This is the circular thing for circular people. And then we'll do some of the linear things too for the other mindset here. But if you will, we see this repeat, especially from the natural disaster as well. There's areas of the world that are prone to natural disasters over and over and over. And what are we doing to help prevent what as best we can the impact of that? Go ahead to the next slide. This is just several different situations where we responded, and it's like, okay, go in here, and what do you do? How do you address the economics of what's going on here? Well, you've got to be relieved first, right? So what do we do? Go ahead to the next slide. And just here's Grenada, September 2004. I think it was after a hurricane. Go ahead, Ben. USA, trigger finger, don't you? Okay. USA Katrina. Go back to that side a little bit. Some guns over here. I don't know what that action is, but that's America. Okay, next slide. Here's the linear stuff, okay? This will help us linear folks get to it too. We have identified as an organization, there's generally five phases of relief that we can respond to. So disaster relief. Life saving happens first 96 hours, first few days. And who's doing that? It's not the Red Cross or the UN or other people. It's local government. It's the local resources. It's private enterprises. It's the military. They're right there. It's their neighbors. They're right there immediately trying to do life savings. Okay. And these time frames, they move all over. This is just somewhat representative, right? Okay, emergency response, it's up to that first, generally, month period. Okay, what's happening then? There's food distribution, shelter, immediate shelter needs being addressed. It's water and sanitation, emergency medical. Who's responding? These are some of the organizations that we already mentioned. UN, Red Cross, International Rescue Agency, organizations like that. In these blue stages, this is where World Relief would normally begin intervening. So blue stages are community stabilization. Okay, so now those organizations above are still there, but organizations like World Vision, World Relief, Capital Police Services, Mercy Corps, and what we're doing then is we're doing transitional shelter. Okay, so maybe the first shelter was a tent, maybe the next shelter is a little bit something more framed and a little bit more sturdy, and may last them, actually people may be in those for a year or so or longer. Livelihood, medical clinics. Livelihood might be some things. We're beginning you go from food distribution, you begin doing distribution, I would say, food for work, or seeds for work, or tools for work. You begin getting, gearing towards
reestablishing some normal patterns. And then we begin doing more clinics and things like that. Maybe not us, but others. Economic recovery, this is when you begin to start seeing some interventions that would be dealing with going beyond just the individuals, but it does start with individuals. So CARE, FINCA, State of Children, CHF, International, permanent shelter, market stimulation, routine medical things. And then infrastructure, that's when you get the larger scale projects. Some of the things you may be more familiar with, World Bank, development banks. There's direct foreign investment can begin again once there's higher levels of stabilization. Just representative, things move on us, right? Economies can be stuck in these phases for an indefinite period. It depends on so many factors, it's quite complex. But this is just to give a bit of an overview of who it is you see at what stage. Go ahead, Benjamin, next slide. Indonesia. It's one of our workers there. Go ahead, next one. There's UNHCR. Go ahead. That's good. A little bit more linear representation, so again, framing what we're talking about tonight. These are what we see, what stages are happening. There's a disaster response stage, development assistance, and then exit or transition out. We as an organization desire to transfer skills, desire to transfer knowledge and practices. As an organization, we'll start with disaster response, and then what we'll move to, we're multi-sectoral, then what we'll move to is what are the development interventions, and that's what this gets to over here. So disaster response is in this area. It's reconstruction, it's rehabilitation, it's food distribution, it's refugee assistance, and then over here, MED, health, food security, refugee resettlement. So we move into that phase after that first 6 months to a year when we've done the DR work. Now we need to go into development work. Refugee resettlement. We're one of 10 agencies the U.S. government uses to sell refugees in the United States. We settle 10% every year. So 5,000 to 7,000 refugees are resettled through our organization. Oftentimes we may be on the ground in that country. Nevertheless, we have 20 offices in the United States settling refugees legally here in the United States. Health would include HIV/AIDS. Some of the efforts in the program tonight and this week is HIV/AIDS work. What we're doing is we're training the nationals to do the work. We come alongside the church and say, pastors, church leaders, do you have issues with AIDS? We've developed curriculum that we'd love to teach your leaders to do and train others to repeat. So it's that 2 Timothy 2:2 process, where we don't have to be the face that's delivering it. We're continuing that training process to continue on after the wrong. Same thing with MED. With MED, we've done, again, many things over many years where we tend to focus on microfinance, but we do other interventions as well. But all of these programs, eventually we want to transition it to local ownership, local capacity. Sometimes it takes longer than we hope. Go to the next slide. Characteristics. Philip mentioned, again, getting this on all, contrasting economic recovery versus long-term development. And this is kind of what's the lay of the land here? Okay, economic recovery, and this will kind of get us to pitfalls. What are you going to be up against if you choose to get into environments where you're trying to serve the poor that have been affected by conflict or natural disaster? So economic recovery says, okay, there's quick, direct provision to households and individuals. What the focus might be is to boost short-term income, restore assets. The focus is on the most vulnerable, okay? So after you've gotten from life savings and you're trying to do the other things, you're trying to get to the most vulnerable people. Okay, funded in short-term increments, monitored and evaluated. Anybody that's doing that work, the monitoring is numbers at the output level, numbers of households you serve, that sort of thing. Generally supervised by relief generalists. And then what happens is there's large sums of money that flow in. It's hot money. You get all the government agencies that just pour in. There's a response from the international community. We want to do good. Some of the great issues with efforts in Indonesia after the tsunami were the billions that flowed in, and the capacity of organizations to ramp up to do the work was not met. It was impossible. It was incredibly difficult. And then the demands were immediate, right? So now show us what you're going to do. Give us a return on that immediately. It's like a difficult situation. Now contrast, and this is the dilemma. Contrast to long-term development. Okay, long-term development. We also want to increase income and assets, but it's by building sustainable institutions, by building sustainable businesses and value chains. It's a different thing. It's shifting from the individuals, and it may be temporary, to sustainable businesses, sustainable institutions. Okay. The focus is going to be more on most likely to succeed. I want to invest in programs that are going to keep going, for businesses that have a life. Funding periods, okay, much longer funding periods. And if we're talking about development work that we might do, we may get a USAID grant for something. The short term of it is maybe it's a 1 or 2 year grant. We'd love to be in that 3 to 4 to 5 year grant, but there's not much of that money. And after it's gone. We've got to get to market mechanisms. We've got to get to mechanisms that will support and sustain things long term. So there's these bridges. Okay, good. And then now evaluating work we might do or work a business would do, it's a little bit more about, okay, yeah, there's numbers of, but it's also the impact. What good are you doing with that? One way of looking at it is we might be judged by some organizations that have invested in our organization with microfinance to say, okay, how many clients did you grow? How many clients did you increase from this period to this period? Well, that's just wonderful, but a better measurement would be, what if we didn't grow any clients, but the clients we did, we brought them from below $1 a day to over $2 a day. What about that? Is that worth something? The truth is, I was visiting clients in Central Africa, Congo, Burundi, and Rwanda. 85% of them are women. And I asked them, okay, tell me what this loan has done for you. It was with a tomato vendor, and there's tomatoes up to here, you know. And she said that $25 loan, with that $25 on working capital, I was able to buy all these tomatoes, and I can resell them. And she said, the difference is I can feed my family 2 meals a day. And I can pay for school fees. And I can pay for medicine. I can put a tin roof instead of a thatch roof over my head. And it's like, okay, that's impact. Now, if we didn't do anything more, that was huge in her life. So that's something we're changing the paradigm over here. Okay, what does require, it requires specialization. In terms of business practices, you've got to focus. You can't do everything. You've got to focus on what you're going to be successful at, what you're going to help somebody else be successful at, that sort of thing. And then again, we've got to go to market driven. We've got to get to sustainable. How do you get there? Those are the questions. So if you will, funding focuses over here at short term, the results are short term, the impact short term. The catch is there's a divide oftentimes when you're trying to go into this setting where that's where people are. How do you get over here to that stabilized environment? Just get a little bit more of go ahead and that's Jordan. That's in Jordan. That's food distribution, medical clinic distribution. Dots. Here's the linkage, pitfalls and remedies. And we observe this as an organization. And if we're considering business interventions, you could be too faced with these same kinds of issues. But stove piping and staff capacity issues. Oftentimes, you go in with a specialty and you kind of do the one thing, that's all you know how to do. In actuality, the market needs other interventions. What are you going to do about that? Well, one way to kind of get around that, when you're trained as specialists in this one program, what World Leaf has done is we don't go in with just one program. The fact is, oftentimes, the greatest need immediately might be health-related. And so, okay, we're going to minister with health related. But you know what? If you help people with their health, they're one day away from destitution. Because there could be a crisis in the family, another storm, another whatever, demands of the family, and how do they meet the needs? So they're one day away from destitution. Income then helps balance that. So we believe in multidisciplinary. The reality is, and we'll get to that here too, you've got to have kind of an orientation as to who you are and what you're doing, but what's the rest of the community doing? Well, how do you integrate? Local capacity, and we believe in this, and again, if you're thinking business models, quickly you should be thinking about not just expats doing the work, but how quickly can you be investing in locals, in local national leadership, training, and passing on the skills and the knowledge that we have. Helping to manage their expectations, and then, do you have an exit strategy? No. Are you there the long term, or is that the right thing? Or should you be there for a time? And kind of be thinking through that process as well. Integration coordination. Again, this is a little bit of information sharing with other agencies, other players on the ground. Oftentimes, you could have seen this before. In a disaster response, 3 different churches show up, and they've got, we've seen this at Katrina. They brought in tons and tons of used clothing. And, when they arrive, it's like, well, nobody needs used clothing. Why weren't you talking to each other? Why weren't you talking to somebody on the ground that knew what was going on? And, this good nature, good intended response was a waste, actually. That has happened over and over. What can we do about that? And that's just a simple example. Believe me, it magnifies in great proportion elsewhere. Community voice. Are we doing things on our own without engaging the local community? What about that? We need to consider. This is honoring to people. It's a right-minded thing to do. And it honors our Lord as well. So engaging the people that we're serving is critical. It really is. We're going to miss something as well. If we're kind of under the radar, sometimes you might be suspect in what you're doing as well. So there's angles with that. And then the community might be able to tell you things you don't know. Oftentimes, right? I did a seminar 2 days ago on avoiding cultural imperialism. But how many mistakes can you make cross-culturally? The list is how long? Wouldn't it be good to engage national leaders to help you with that? Church leaders can help you with that. Implementation tools. Here's the thing. Whatever industry you're thinking about or business you're thinking about, let's be smart about it. Let's think industry development, whatever sector you're going to be going into. I know in Kosovo, USAID has funded trade association work. I don't know how successful they are, but the idea is to have industry standards with certain industries. Well, great, that's a good thing to do. The reality is many industries have standards and measurements and evaluations that can be collectively used and shared over and over. And would you put the next slide? Financial services. This is the fun stuff. What about this? Okay. We mentioned what does poverty look like? Living hand to mouth, minimal external resources. Money can be quickly spent or easily stolen. That's the truth. We know of a situation in Africa, in Malawi, when a woman marries, she marries into the husband's family. She's a part of that family. If her husband dies, the reality is she is divorced from the family. She's cast out from the family, and she really isn't supposed to go back to her old family either, but she is stripped of all of her possessions, her house, her wealth, whatever. It belongs to that family. And so when we start talking about money easily spent or easily stolen,
even the family can make demands on you. And what about that? There's no safe place, liquid place to have savings. Emergency money for external shocks, sickness, natural disasters, or opportunities, you know, investment opportunities. That's the face of poverty. And I opened it earlier by saying, okay, here's the world's poor, 2 billion people, maybe 1 billion people under $1 a day. We're working with the segment that's in those conflicted areas. And then those are already disadvantaged, marginalized people. And the women in those settings are even more marginalized. They're even more affected and even more vulnerable. And oftentimes, they're the ones responsible for children. So they've got great responsibility, great burdens, and they're most affected. So this is a reality. So these minor difficulties, just even in a normal setting, these minor things for the poor are issues of life or death. Food for the Hungry had a little book, I remember. It was Hungry Decisions. I used to do it in some of our training. You know, you have this poor woman or this poor man, and okay, what decision do you make? You know, do you buy food for the day, or do you buy seed, you know, to grow the crop? Okay, well, I bought food for the day. Okay, great. Well, you didn't get enough seed planted, so therefore you're going to miss 2 months of food for, you know, in 6 months, something like this. And then every decision was a difficult decision. It's like, oh my gosh, let me go back and reverse it. I'll try the other one. And that's a difficult one. Every decision is compounded, and it's worse and it's worse and it's worse. These are basically life or death situations for poor, and especially for children. They're even more marginalized. Thank you. Have you heard the fishing analogy, the Chinese proverb? Yeah. Have you ever heard some? No. Okay. If you give a man a fish, you feed him for a day. If you teach a man to fish, you feed him for a lifetime. Cool. However, we'll go a little bit further on that, okay? Some of our loans in Cambodia are for nets, fishing boats. And if they don't have capital resources, what are they? They may be in bondage to somebody else that owns the boat and the net. Or maybe they're going to just fish for the stream. And who knows? So we kind of tend to play this out a little bit to say, you know, there's more to it even. But we go with the concept, but an advanced development concept would take us there. Go to the next slide. Microfinance. Who knows what some of the fundamental concepts of microfinance are? Thank you. Go ahead.
Small groups of people that need a little start of capital to start something like them, purchase cages for chickens, take up a crop for a week later.
Okay.
So it's just a small amount.
Good. And who can tell me more about microfinance? That's a good premise. Why should we trust the poor people to repay that loan?
Usually it's done as a group where we have people who are committed to each other to help keep their capital, and we're working with them, a local loan officer. They usually someone who's familiar with the village or part of the area that they're working in. And so that's a pretty big system of trust that's built up before those are produced. Then we have actually compelling business financing, usually the same amount of training that we go with the board of work.
Sorry, Andrew?
Microfinance, and they found that with the women that they would come home to like a very comfortable room and they're still looking to help provide their families, for their children, that's, it's their responsibility.
Big motivation.
Yeah. So I have that here. Yes, sir.
With my children, we have interest.
Sure. Good question. I'll answer that then. So, and I'll maybe just give a little bit more kind of background to what's already been said. I was a commercial loan officer in the United States, and I learned there's the 5 C's of credit, and I've forgotten one already. It's been too many years. But character, capacity, creditworthiness, collateral, again, whatever that 5th C was, and so loan, cash flow, yeah, I love it, good, I love that, was a good one. Were you a banker?
Commercial officer.
Very good, sir. So now, when we're in an impoverished setting, the poor, well, let's see, cash flow, okay, what about that, huh? Collateral, well, oftentimes, no. Capacity, no. Especially post-conflict or post-disaster, right? Well, character is what you come down to, okay? And, the poor are too poor to repay a loan. But the character, and that's part of what we're talking about, there's an integrity, there's a social responsibility, your name's involved, there's an obligation. It's based around character. What happens is the common methodology is developed around a group banking model, and you do some training before you lend money. You tell them how the program works, you tell them what's responsible, and in fact they do guarantee each other's loans. They get to choose who gets in the group. So now if I've got two brother-in-laws and one's a bum, doesn't work at all, and one's a really hard worker, and I just heard about this loan program, and it's like, man, this is the best thing since sliced bread. We got to get in this. Well, am I going to invite in my brother-in-law that doesn't work? And now the catch is, if he doesn't repay his loan, I'm partially responsible for that. I'm not going to bring him in, am I? So there's that social cohesion and obligation, and it's based on character, because they know. I was in Cambodia. In a rural village, a distant village out in a very remote area, where we were doing dispersing loans, and it was so wonderful. And man, we were really in a distant area, and there were five women that came forward. We had all the loan documents all laid out, and they would stamp their thumb signature alongside the loan document. We had bundles of money ready for them, and something was going on while they were meeting before we dispersed the loans, and I didn't know what was going on, and our two loan officers there working the program, and one of the women turned around and left. It's like, okay, what happened? So four of the women put their fingerprint down and they got the money, and I said, so what just happened here? And they said, well, that fifth person, she's known to be irresponsible, and they didn't want the responsibility of having to pay back her loan. And I was uncomfortable. I mean, I was really uncomfortable. That's not how you do banking in the States. But you know what? They knew what was going on there. And there's history there. And there's a character assessment that I could never make. They understood that. Now, that's one of the things. So that means microenterprise, microfinance, doesn't necessarily get down to the every poor person, does it? It doesn't go down to the lowest levels of the poor. It only will work at the, because we want a sustainable program, right? It'll only work at the lowest economically active levels of the poor. Okay, interest. Interest rates. Yes, interest is charged. This is a fascinating subject as well. What are the alternatives to what they're being charged as well? When we go into a country, depending on the country, depending, it's A to Z, right? But we might be lending money at 4% interest a month, 5% interest a month, maybe as high as 6% interest a month. 4% interest a month times 12 months would be 48% interest annually. And that may sound high, but what we're trying to do is achieve, it's not for us, it's to pay for the program. lots of little loans with loan officers dispersing those little loans and collecting those loan payments. Now, in contrast, however, if that person, oftentimes what's happening is they're buying product and they're reselling product, so they had no capital before. Now that capital, they might be making 400% profit a month, so paying a 4% for a loan interest rate is not bad. And the alternative is what? The alternative is no economic activity, that's one alternative, or the loan sharks. And the loan sharks are very difficult. We had one of our workers who was born in Vietnam, and she ministered for many years in Indonesia, and she said, Bill, I've seen this face to face. She said, the loan sharks there, it's a 5-6 loan program. We lend you $5 today, we want $6 tomorrow. And that's 20% interest in one day. That's 600% interest in a month. That's 7,200% interest annually. That is a very common lending scenario. And if you take it one step further, and if you don't pay, what are the alternatives? And oftentimes the alternative is destitution. Just incredible things. So that's part of the interest rate. Now, what about, isn't that high? Does it ever come down? The reality is, most programs only want to charge as much, not as the market can bear, but we want to cover costs and get sustainable. When you have enough clients covering some of those fixed costs, now you can get up to a scale where it can be sustainable. And the market itself is going to push down interest rates. More competition pushes down interest rates. So in other markets, we may be lending 2% per month. So it just depends on where we are at. We're not trying to make gobs of money. We're trying to build a program, sustain a program, and what about that? So those are just right up there. Go ahead.
Yep. That was one thing, too. The interest rates are skewed, too, when you think of the size of the loans that are being made. So since it's only on $100, it's not like here in America when we compare 8% or whatever to $1,000.
Yeah, that's right. And, oftentimes, that's one of the issues. In America, we're saying, well, gee, I can get, my home equity line of credit, and I can get, 8% interest. Yes, and you're in the best capital market in the whole world, the most efficient market. You've got all these systems and standards evaluating your credit worthiness, and there's collateral behind that, and your capacity to earn income. How can you even compare? There's no comparison. It's quite amazing. It really is. I'll go one step further with this too, and we're going to get into it here. So this is multiplying loaves and fishes. And these are at miracle scales. They really are. We get to see multiplication happen. Every $50 in Central Africa, on average, can launch a business. It blesses a family, a community, and a country. Every dollar loan is repaid and relent. The basic program is something like a 16-week installment program that's paid back over. Most of our programs, we kind of force a savings component too. So we say, okay, you got to pay a little bit more, but it's savings, it's for you. After the loan's paid, it's available to you. Do you want that? Do you want that now? If you want to keep it with us, the next loan cycle, which will be a little bit higher, will be a little bit more higher because you've had a savings component as well. It's still their savings. So we help them begin that process of savings, and we're a safe place to have their savings.
What's the success rate?
Let's go this route. Our repayment rate on average is about 97% to 98%. Okay, there's banks in America that don't have that kind of repayment rate. Now the catch is that's the loan side of it, right? Getting our operating costs covered, that's the challenge, right? So we work especially post-conflict. So after a war setting, it may be a few years before we're ever going to get to a break-even scenario, maybe longer. In Mozambique, Ben, how long was our program in Mozambique going before we got to a sustainable model?
About
9 or 10 years. That's a long road to hoe to get to where it can be stabilized. Stabilized means covering your operating costs, where you don't have to just keep pouring startup money in.
Yeah.
I saw. Did I say that? Okay, good. Thank you. Yes, sir.
And how does, with World Relief specifically, because, you know, some microfinance institutions are just trying to cover their costs, others are trying to be profitable. And do you, this World Relief, for example, where does the money come from? Is it from other
good.
Other city, or countries, pointing to countries that aren't sustainable yet? Or
good.
A lot of
good questions.
Fundraising?
What we, our standard mode of operating is that we will use some of that hot money that can pour into a disastrous scenario. Our most recent programs were in Congo and Burundi. We started in 2004. There was some money because there's still conflict. There's still conflict in Congo. In the last 20 years, 4 million people have died in Congo, the Democratic Republic of Congo. They're still fighting. And we're operating in an area that there's still rebels. But there'll be money that can come in, and we've got some USAID money for those two countries. I think the grant was $4 million for those two countries. We're investing that in microfinance programs, food programs in those countries, as well as we're doing sector development. So we're helping the microfinance sector. We're doing training to our competitors to help them get their programs up to speed as well. Now, what happens is, with that kind of money, that will require oftentimes a match. And so we'll get money. We'll get money through the church. Churches will donate. Individuals will donate. Major donors, foundations. And oftentimes, in the big picture of World Relief, I'll just kind of say this, we also do health programs and disaster response and so forth. We get in annually about $50 million, plus or minus. About a third of that we raise privately, and about two-thirds of that, these are really rough numbers, two-thirds of that might be U.S. State Department and USAID. So we'll absolutely use the money the government will give us to work, but we'll do that in a startup scenario, especially in these post-conflict areas. So the good news is, once we've honored the grants and we've been fulfilling the responsibilities of the government, that money stays in that program, and that's equity. That's equity in the program. That's interesting, because we'll start from an NGO program, from a nonprofit. We'll start informal, unregulated, as best as we can, and we start as a program. And we'll start with, honest to goodness, an Excel spreadsheet, and maybe a shoebox, and a lot of thumbprints, and we'll grow a program. Our program in Cambodia, up until this year, we got up to 12,500 clients, a portfolio of, when we did it, about $3 million. They were still working on a Lotus 1-2-3 spreadsheet. Do you know how many lines the Lotus 1-2-3 spreadsheet has? About 65,000, something like that. And because we filled out a Lotus 1-2-3 spreadsheet, I mean, we do a lot with a little, and it's like that. We should have replaced that years ago, but we had good people that could keep working it. but that's to say, we go in cheap. We try to get, as we move it though from the NGO model of cheap, then we need to start building in capacity to get to market-driven models. In Cambodia, our program called Credit is now an LLC. It's a profit-generating organization. It pays taxes, and it's throwing off now a sustainable return. Now the fun part of this is, okay, so with that grant money that stayed in the program, and that was equity, we got up to about $2 million of equity in the program. Once you're sustainable and throwing off cash, you know what's happened? The fun part is the capital markets have figured this out. The banks want to get in because, you know, I was a commercial loan officer for 16 years. And I remember about 15, 20 years ago, our senior vice president was in an industry meeting, and he said, you know, we as a bank can't lend a commercial loan in the United States in Phoenix, Arizona, under $250,000 and make it profitable. We can't make a profit on a loan under $250,000. And our institution was a $10 billion bank, so we knew what we were doing, and that's what he said. And that was reality back then, because technology didn't allow us to get there. Well, technology's moved to where it's, you know, it's now home phones by loan, you know, call up 30 minutes later, they pulled your credit score and your all sorts of history, and $50,000 loans like this, you know, no problem. Well, the reality is, doing these small loans takes a lot of effort and a lot of capacity. To get to the LLC side, you have to get to a certain scale. But now what's happened is the capital markets have figured this out. We're able to borrow money now. So our program in credit in Cambodia, I think we had $1.5 million of debt that we borrowed and we put on the books. We're able to turn that money, though. It's just inventory, right? We're able to turn that money and make enough return so that we can extend our reach, repay that loan. What's occurring now, nobody really knows, but there may be about 10,000 microfinance institutions in the world. Any church can start one, so they pop up all the time. There's maybe 200 that are profitable and sustainable. They're kind of called tier ones. But I tell you what, Citibank, Deutsche Bank, Morgan Stanley, they know who those are. And they're knocking on the doors, and they're wanting to give money. Now, some of it's kind of social money, which is a little bit benevolent yet. So there's some people want to do good, and so there's funds that have developed. That's okay. We'll use that money. But that's the neat part. We can start growing these into more sustainable and larger institutions. Yes, sir?
How do you identify the business that you give loans to?
Okay. Well, you know what? We don't. What we do is we gather people. And World Relief is mandated to work alongside the church. So that's kind of the beautiful story. When we go in, we find out where's the church. We're not going to be the institution of the church, but we're going to work alongside it. So what we'll do is we'll gather alongside the church and we'll say, we're going to be introducing a loan program. And it's a loan program where we're going to be teaching scriptural values, good ethic values, and so forth. You know, Mr. Pastor or lay leader or whatever, would you know people in the community that could use that value? So we come alongside. The people themselves that we lend to, we will teach them certain things. Now, there may be instruction, you know, how many fish vendors should there be? How many shoe cobblers should there be? And what about that? You know, but really, the market's going to get saturated with some of those. Some of those businesses are not going to succeed. But it's market-driven. We're not going to be dictating which ones do or don't. So we're not as concerned with what they do. It's up to them to turn that money and make a profit. Yes?
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, there's so many microfinance institutions going into developing cities and countries. How does World Relief actually differentiate itself as a Christian organization, or if it does? And you explain that they come from sexually.
Right.
So beyond that, you know, like, you partner in any church, or like,
yeah,
you go beyond, you know, with the implementation.
Yeah. Are you a setup? Did you just come to my, just to ask that very question? Because that's a great question. I love it. Tell you what, it looks different in different settings. It really does. In sub-Saharan Africa, where there's a lot of work in the church already, and Ben can tell you, Ben's worked in two of our programs there, maybe three of our programs there. It's worshipful. It's wonderful. I love hearing our devotional songs in our programs in Congo and Burundi and Rwanda. It's just like heaven. So there's a lot of devotions that are going on every week. We gather the groups for training, for telling them about the program. We are praying before that meeting. We often give a scripture message during the meeting, and we close in prayer. And our loan officers are praying with people. Our program in Rwanda, called Urwego, which means ladder, like climbing the ladder of success. Man, they get grilled, the people they employ, they get grilled. It's like, are you a believer? Yes, yes, yes. Okay, good. What kind of leadership are you doing in the church? Well, I'm leading the choir. Well, that's not good enough. How long have you been leading the choir? And they grill people. It's like, oh my goodness, that's an extreme, okay? And every person there, the reality is, and I would say my observation in those countries, in those settings, it's almost like family inside the program. And they are praying with clients as the needs happen. And there's, we're affected in those regions by HIV/AIDS and other issues. There's a great deal of prayer and support that's going on directly. Okay, contrast that. We also have done work in Cambodia. We went in after the Khmer Rouge, after the killing fields. And our first intervention was a VR intervention. After we did humanitarian aid, the next intervention is microfinance. And we began stabilizing populations with these small loans. And we were faithful to say we're a Christian organization. We're here by the love of Christ. And we're going to be doing, now this isn't free money. You have to pay it back. But they knew who we were, and they wanted to know more. We started Bible studies alongside. There wasn't much of a church presence there, perhaps less than 0.1% when we began our programs there. But you know what happened? They saw the physical blessing. The next program that entered in, we did child survival. We were helping mothers understand hygiene and practices that are different for babies, helping the babies live. And they were just all over us. Tell us more about this Jesus you serve. We're now connected to a house church movement that's over 600 churches in Cambodia. And it's a wonderful thing. And it's a blessing. And now, I would say, and I've got some friends of ours here from our program in Kosovo. Kosovo is in an area that doesn't have as much church presence. Program's going to look different there. We're not going to have every employee is going to be a believer, but the manager will be. And now that manager, one of their roles would be just ministering to the staff. And that may be the effectiveness that they do to extend out the reach. So it's absolutely different in different settings. And so there's no cookie cutter, and it won't work the same way in every setting. But we are intentional about it. We're mandated to work with the church where it exists, and then we've got some of the methodologies that we hold accountable. Yes?
I've been doing it because I've been working with this manager. It's like I've been working with a small organization there, like trying to build a true farm and like coffee company. But how do you work cross-culturally? Because so many people of the world, the communities, we're in a completely different space than the Western world. And it's like, how do you kind of motivate them to? Because we're regional zones too, but we're kind of doing like we can do about like that. Where do you draw the line between that? Because like the Indonesian culture especially, it's a very like being culture, whereas we're a very doing culture. And we're very focused on relations and like just being out. So like how do you kind of how do you motivate cultures like that to really like
those are tough things, and I tell you what, we will kind of one more of our methodologies here is we'll go into a country and we're going to look for national partners. So if there's already an organization, a national-led organization doing that work, we may come alongside them and help them improve their program and that. I tell you what, we had quasi microcredit program. We didn't even know what we were doing, but it's happening in the field in Malawi, I believe it was, and it was a food, a seed for work. Okay, we're going to give you money for seeds and tools, and after the harvest, you pay us back. And sounded like a good concept, but it was somewhat that kind of environment, kind of a loose thing, and all that. And we got 9% of the loans, the money we paid. And the reality is, we didn't have good discipline. We did not set up the right format and the right structure. Microfinance probably can work in any culture, but you've got to be the disciplinarian of that. It's hard. And you've got to enforce it. And that's the reality, because you need a transparent organization. There's organizations that say, well, we work with, let me just name and what we do. There are certain populations that are going to be high risk, harder to work with, and yet they're disadvantaged and we want to do something with them. So we'll try to do special programs, but we've got to be careful how we do it. So some of the high-risk groups might be people with AIDS. It might be people coming out of trafficked situations. It might be decommissioned ex-combatants. Well, if you've got a bunch of ex-combatants coming out of Burundi, and most of our programs are 85% women. We've got these men that were former guerrillas, and we put them into a group with these women. That's not a good thing. That's not going to work, okay? I'd be frightened, Okay. So we've got to do certain things to work with them and isolate and control and contain that. And what's real? And the reality is, we're going to lose money with that group. We're going to lose money with working with AIDS-only focused groups. We're going to lose money working with people coming out of traffic situations because they're just up against so many difficult things. But now, if we do it right, can the greater program sustain those things that may be more benevolent-minded? And we know we're going to be subsidizing them. But the truth is the rest of the program has to work in concert together. Most of our losses, and when we talked about what's our return, we lose 2-3%, we get a 97-98% return. Actually, and I think it's maybe in Rwanda, programs like that, a lot of our losses actually are people that have died, and we don't ask the group to repay those loans. Other programs will do microinsurance. The catch with that is it'll be mandatory, it's an additional cost, something you've got to administer. But some of that's kind of good too. We might be looking at microinsurance. Microinsurance is kind of credit insurance, it would pay the loan off, but it also gives the family maybe $700, and that way it would pay for burial expenses and some extra money beyond that. And that can happen as well. But, you have to have discipline, you have to have transparency, because I guess the catch is, if you have a group that people say, oh, well, that's a certain group, and they're not going to repay their loans, so then I don't have to repay my loan either. And, well, I'm friends with them, and they didn't repay their loan, and it's like, no, no, you got problems. So you've got to instill discipline. Maybe what you do is you go to shorter, how do you do this, Ben? Shorter loan terms forces repayment quicker, but the dollar amounts amounts are higher. Well, you're talking about the collection process. That's something we can talk more about maybe later. But yeah, there's ways to speed that up and a lot more face-to-face time. Yeah, I believe so. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, it is. I don't know if there's too many reasons why, and we may not know all the reasons, but the reality is we will focus towards women. About 85% of our clients are women. And there's a couple reasons that we'll do that. One is because they are more marginalized. They're going to be more affected. Another reason is they're often caring for the family and needs. They're going to be, their motivation is to be responsible to their family. And we don't want to say that in a disparaging sense, but there's some factor there that we've got to be wise to, right? As well, the forms we've adopted, there are self-help groups in many cultures, in many villages, in many settings. So what's occurred with microfinance is the industry has observed cultural norms in societies. Oftentimes women are gathering in societies to do certain communal things together. And so what's occurred is, I think Dr. Muhammad Yunus observed this and began building the methodology around it, is you're already observing certain things within society that exist. And so that does tend to happen. I don't know if men in many of these cultures do that kind of a thing, but many kinds of women do. And again, maybe centered around caring for communal things, village needs and such. So I think it's a little bit of an anthropological, sociological component as well. But the reality is they tend to pay back the loans better as well. Now, the best scenario is when it is a husband wife working together. And when we see that happening, it's exciting. Because then there's a lot more capacity to get bigger and grow bigger and maybe even employ others. So that's more the ideal scenario. You know what? That's a good tie-in to this. And so we mentioned some of these issues. This is real. We've got some, we're running out of them, but we've got some some flyers up here. There's an article written by Laura Van Buren. She was on our staff up until just this last year. She wrote an article about dignity, but especially some of these issues of destitution are real. And so oftentimes women are faced with more of those destitute situations, and men don't want to bother. And I can work on my own and make my own thing. So it's an interesting dynamic. But getting to dignity, this is kind of a fun thing. And I'm not going to say anything bad about any other organization here today, okay? But but the fun thing about microfinance is when I said, and I've interviewed people, and I said, okay, we give you a $50 loan, and you're able to stabilize a whole family with $50, with two meals a day, pays for school, and now we've got medicine being provided for, and shelters are being paid. Okay, $50 a day. Now, they have to pay it back to us. And then we get the lender back, and they pay it back. But they pay it back. What's occurred now is that person, oftentimes that woman, is providing for her family. So she's gaining dignity. Now, it's not outside money that's so important. It's what she's done for her family. So we've turned the development paradigm upside down. We've gone from a welfare scenario of grants, and that's where the risk is. If we have loan programs that are really grant programs, let's get that free money from the Westerners, because we don't have to pay it back. Well, what have we done there? And they'll just keep, they're dumb enough to keep giving us the money. Well, okay, that's one bad reflection on that. But a better reflection is, what we've done is we've allowed that person to be the breadwinner, to have dignity of work, that there's all of a sudden there's hope. We've given them something that's invaluable. It's really large. And you know what? In God's economy, A to Z, there's all sorts of things we could be doing as a body of faith in different programs. So let's all do many programs. There's a lot of wealth in the West that we should be shoveling resources. That's no question about that. But I would say microfinance is a fascinating thing. It's different than I'm going to have to pay $50 a month to this program. If I was giving $50 a month as an individual to a microfinance program, I'm going to talk about impact. I was in Congo, in Goma, and I held up my family's photo, and I have four daughters. And I like to say I have one wife, four daughters. That means I'm in women's ministry. And then I was meeting with this group, primarily women, and they were all our community bank officers. They all were running groups of 20 or 30 people. And they were the president of that group, and the treasurers and the secretaries of that group. And they were at a meeting that we were having. It was way cool. They had names. They'd given their banks. They were community banks. And I passed around my photo with my children and my daughter's marriage, and I said, okay, well, who here has four children? I'd ask them, right? All the hands were up. Whoa, okay, good. And our director's a single man there, and said, oh, poor Ellie, he didn't do it. I said, well, now, who here, okay, if you have 500 more children, keep your hand up. And most of the hands were up. Okay, six or more children. Okay. Seven more children. Wow, a lot of hands still up. Eight or more children, a lot of hands up. Nine or more children. Okay, half the hands are down. 10 or more children. There was a person there with 11 children. It's like, oh my goodness, we clapped for her. That's wow, And I said, well, and then somebody told me, kind of interrupted me, and said, some of our children are our nieces and nephews. They're war orphans. So, wow, that's pretty good too. So they had large families, and then they were caring for extended families because they were orphans. And all of a sudden, the gravity of this just numbed me, because now we have not only that $50 loan stabilizing that entrepreneur, talk about impact, stabilizing a family of 5 to 10 people. So now we've got leverage. So when we talk about multiplying hoes and fishes, it's off the charts. It's off the charts, which is really exciting. Really exciting stuff. Okay. He gave me a signal on that too. Very good. Physical blessings, just help with the spiritual blessing. If we're there doing the spiritual, the physical good, and who are you? Well, we're believers in Christ. Wow, that gives impact to the gospel message of holding faith in Christ as well. But then, that was the group I was talking about that had 10 or more children or more children. We'll probably close right here then. But when I took that photo, I said, boy, you're like a flower garden. Look how beautiful you are. Just all. And I finally got a few smiles out of the group. And then you're smiling the whole time, and then you pull the camera up. Not going to smile. So, wonderful. Just lovely people. Just praying God's blessing. But that's all now. I guess any further last questions? I need to be respectful of time and allow for. I'll stay here later. We do have up here, we've got a DVD. It's just a 7.5 minute DVD that talks about microfinance. So it kind of capsulizes this. Probably says it better than I did. You know, it does it in 7 minutes. So. You don't even have to stay here. You just get that DVD and left. And then a little bit more information about what our microfinance program looks like. You're welcome to that. Any last questions?
Yes, sir. Just on the sheet, it says on one of the slides, personally, I have their website, but it says www.org. So I was wondering if that was just a typo or was it supposed to be a website?
What's our website, Don?
WR.
WR. Sorry. Good catch. Yes, sir.
If time permits, can you quickly go through about the concerned issues, such as being supply driven and also, over the boundary issues like that?
Okay, good. Okay, Ben, go to the next slide. Trying to pull this up. Value chains. That's another NED methodology. Value chains would gather producers, of products, and it's an industry segment, And it is a methodology that can be considered and can be used, and it's one of those that's out there. We would say microfinance is at this level. Value chains begin to go higher levels, right? Now what you're doing is you're gathering producers. You're trying to create standards. You're trying to help them get their products to markets. It may be markets, national markets. It may be foreign markets. Now the catch is, the downsides could be, if you're only supply driven, so you go into an economy, and I've seen this countless number of times. Well, in this market, we produce doilies, little handicraft things. It's like, wow, we could sell those at Walmart. So let's just get, let's mass produce a bunch of doilies. They haven't done their market research. So that's a supply-driven mechanism. The other thing that can happen is you may flood the market with everybody's doing doilies, or you do carpenters training. Just how many carpenters do you need, or how many plumbers or shoemakers do you need? Sometimes there's programs that come in and oversaturate a market. So that's what can happen as well. And again, from our perspective, you need a more stabilized market than oftentimes we see from our segment. Thank you.
There's another seminar here in like 8 minutes. So I think there are three World Relief representatives. So if you have further questions, grab on the back from here. Our speaker, who give a round of applause?
Father, we just thank you for this time for the people here, and Father, we just ask your blessing on them. Father, just give them boldness and courage to do what they should do. Father, give them great wisdom. Father, give them blessing, and Father, we pray for a great return in the kingdom from everybody that's here. Father, we just commit this time to you in Jesus' name.